approaches this. So he promotes something which I don't think is his invention, but it's the dual inheritance model, which is that there are two parallel tracks, culture and biology. Or let's reverse it. So for you have cultural evolution, so you have biological evolution, which is what we know a lot about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Random genetic mutation leading to natural selection for the most beneficial random mutations. Those will be carried forward. And that's on one track, and it's running parallel to, in humans at least, to cultural evolution, which is this ongoing cumulative process of cultural change from generation to generation, cultural values. And also scientific knowledge would probably be included in that, because the underlying natural laws haven't changed over the millennia, but human knowledge about those natural laws, about the natural world, has presumably, arguably increased, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we could poke holes in that. There's a couple of ways to poke holes in that. One is that there's been some examples of past cultures that had more scientific knowledge than we thought they did, and then it disappeared, right? It disappeared somewhere. When the culture dissolved. And then, you know, one could also argue that, well, we might think we know a lot, but we certainly don't know enough to save the world from impending doom of global warming and so on. But so I guess one can question whether there's really been this like progression from worse to better. An adamant judgment to it around our scientific knowledge. Maybe it's not that way at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, that might be a natural conclusion to draw. I mean, wasn't one of the conclusions drawn from natural selection a kind of ateleologizing of biology? You can have an evolution that is going towards something, but under natural selection and things like random mutations, just adapting to environments, that's the end point that you would need for a teleology it's no longer there. And it's not, and even if it were, it's not being directed to it because the mechanism is completely random. So we don't have to worry about.
You can say that.
So I'm saying it would make, if these two things are parallel, if it's being ateleologized in the biological sense, it's probably also being ateleologized in the cultural sense as well. So we don't have to worry about when we have these questions of, or we have these comments of, oh, aren't we so smart? We're bringing ourselves to our own end here. I mean, the irony, it feels like it's there in our own experience, but that isn't necessarily true. I mean, a scientific society could do that to itself as it is.
Right. I got interested in Joe Heinrich's presentation of the dual inheritance model because of its, to me, it seems like there's contradictions in it. So inheritance implies, in my mind at least, inheritance applies the type of causal chain that we see with genetic biological evolution, the per accident causal chain, where once the change happens, it's done. You don't need the original stimulus anymore. That's, to me, what the idea of inheritance implies. Like, I was born and I inherited various characteristics, various biological characteristics. The question that I raised before is, do I also inherit cultural characteristics? That's the question that I'm not prepared to answer definitively. So when Heinrich talks about dual inheritance, the implication is that he's claiming that in some way culture is also inherited in that per accidens fashion, in the same way that that genes are inherited. Or maybe he is he claiming that culture rides piggyback on the genes. So I got interested in that. So when I read his stuff and listened to his stuff, I got confused. And I'll continue with that in a moment, but since we're a little past the halfway point, I just want to say that you are listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. We're talking about biological evolution, cultural evolution, getting sidetracked onto various topics in philosophy because they're all intertwined. And my name is Michael Robert Kaditz. My co-host here today is Brandon Brownlee, the Canadian Philosophy Show. And we'll continue now with my thoughts about the research I've done on biological and cultural evolution. I got interested in Heinrich's claim around sort of the parallel or the perhaps the analogous development of cultural evolution to biological evolution, because he says that it's dual inheritance. So presumably I'm born, I inherit both biological traits from the biological track and I inherit cultural traits from the cultural track. I asked myself, well, how do I inherit cultural traits? Is Heinrich arguing that I'm not born tabula rasa, but I'm actually born with viewpoints? I'm actually born with a belief that marijuana should be legal. Or is he saying I'm born with a predisposition to believing that? Or what's he saying? Have I inherited my cultural viewpoints around drug legalization? It seems like a big claim to make.
Yeah.
But then when I go deeper into his stuff, he says very explicitly that culture is transmitted through sense perception.
Mm.
So then I think, well, that's contradictory to inherited, because if sense perception is what transmits culture, then I wasn't born with it. I only got it through my senses when it was taught to me, or I internalized it from my environment.
Right.
That would imply the per se type of causal chain where I wouldn't have it unless that original stimulus was there. So unless I learned liberal attitudes around marijuana legalization from my peers, from my parents, from books, from TV, from school, whatever it might be, I wouldn't have that viewpoint. So which is it? Joe, which is it? Is culture inherited or is it learned?
It's a bit of a problem. I feel like there's a bit of an original position move that can be made, in that maybe in this original evolutionary picture, things are not so, like with the idea of, you know, tolerance for marijuana versus intolerance, those two opposing ideas might exist in a society, but in the kind of human situation in which our brains are having to adapt to evolving into being cultural, we might not have such complex debates about these kinds of things. I don't want to be unfair to the example and say, well, we weren't debating marijuana back then. That's not the point. The point is that maybe when we're born into we're born into a human community, we aren't born with our cognitions, but we are born into a situation in which we do take those up, and we necessarily take those up because as cognitive beings, those are the only ideas that we will be able to uptake, and that's sort of a part of our birth. Because it's difficult to imagine a human being born, and then there's this gap. There's this little sliver of time between being produced materially and encountering the culture, right? Now, if it's just that inheritance happens at the moment of conception or at the moment of being born, I mean, that might be... I mean, maybe Heinrich is asking us to alter our conception of what it means to be born or what it means to inherit things. By being born into an environment, don't we, in a way, inherit that environment?
And trying to make sense of the dual inheritance model... For a moment, I'm going to forget that I heard the claim that culture is transmitted through sense perception, which Heinrich said, because I think that throws a monkey wrench in. So let's say we don't know how culture is transmitted. Then Heinrich begins, at least, with a claim that at least some aspects of culture are transmitted genetically and selected for through natural selection. So he sort of walks the edges of that claim. And here's how he does it. He says that the capacity for culture was selected for through genetic natural selection because human individuals throughout, you know, evolutionary history who had the capacity, the intelligence, the brain power to get together with other people and form a culture, they were selected for because they were more likely to thrive, survive, have offspring. So he claims, and it's probably fairly uncontroversial, that the capacity for culture, just like, and he talks about this too, the capacity to make tools, the capacity to store food, the capacity to harness fire, to cook food, that all those things provided a biological advantage to individual humans. And so those capacities were selected for genetically through the process of natural selection. In other words, there were standing mutations. Let's say we could go back in time to, you know, a time when humans didn't have the capacity to figure out how to make fire. So in theory, at least, there would have been some random genetic mutations or variations of individuals that like were super smart, had more brain power or had more of a capacity to figure out how to harness fire. Eventually, because there was that increased the fitness of those individuals, eventually that became a more common trait and eventually worked its way into like the predominant characteristic of the human species. That's how the biological natural selection would have worked. So Heinrich does say that. He doesn't go quite so far as to say that specific beliefs would be transmitted genetically.
Right.
Again, my point is that he says that capacities were selected for genetically, but he doesn't go as far as to say that specific beliefs. Another way of saying it would be that capacity for culture is favored genetically, transmitted genetically, but not the contents of the culture. So he doesn't say that, but that's what I'm saying. So I'm characterizing his claims as capacity, but no claim about the content.
Yeah, and that makes sense to me. I mean, it's interesting in the case of something like producing fire being naturally selected for. It's difficult to imagine how that wouldn't be a kind of bundled adaptation, you know? Like if you can figure out how to produce fire, the thing that you would have to select for to be able to do that would also be the capacity for other things, right? It seems to be a capacity for a kind of natural insight into properties, and that's generalizable. So something like a capacity being naturally selected for and then kind of favoring other things as well that didn't necessarily actually check the evolutionary process, because it's a generalizable capacity, you now open up the possibility of other things happening.
There's another nuance to this, which I thought about, which is that there's another stage in between capacity and specific content, which would be predisposition. Let me give you an example. Suppose you didn't want to go as far as to claim that the specific belief about legalizing drugs would be transmitted genetically, but you wanted to go further than to say that the capacity to think about, the intellectual ability to even think about, to make a rational analysis of drug legalization, that would be transmitted genetically. But there's something in between, which is the predisposition to be open-minded or liberal in your views around drug legalization. Maybe that could be transmitted genetically. So maybe the characteristic of being more open-minded or more tolerant is a random mutation, biological mutation, which could be propagated genetically. So I'm just throwing out this, this hypothesis, perhaps worthy of further research. So could you say that to the extent human rights, the belief in human rights, the belief in universal human rights has become more prevalent than, say, it was, even several hundred years ago? There's more recognition, especially in the Western world and other parts of the world, that human rights, is a thing. It's like there's innate human rights. So arguably, that is a value that's developed more over time. Arguably, I'm saying arguably because, again, I'm not sure there's a linearity here that some people would dispute it, but let's hypothesize for a moment. By hypothesis, let's say that over the last number of centuries, there's been a gradual progression toward more recognition of justice, human rights, equality, respect for minorities, respect for, LGBT plus people, that these more tolerant attitudes have developed progressively, culturally.
Yeah.
Now, so without making a claim as to the specific beliefs, the specific belief being something like, we should allow gay marriage. That's a very specific belief. So I'm not going to suggest that specific belief might be transmitted genetically. I'm raising the possibility of whether predispositions to have certain views or certain cultural beliefs do transmit, develop genetically. So that would be one way of linking cultural and biological evolution. But going back to the dual inheritance model, it's problematic to make this claim of analogy between cultural and biological. Seems problematic because you have to deal with this issue of whether, in my terminology, the transmission is per se or per accidents, or to put it more commonly used terminology, is culture transmitted from generation to generation genetically, or does it need to be relearned or learned anew by each generation of human organisms? I'm bookmarking that because I don't know the answer to that. I just know that cultural evolution's difficult. It's problematic because we don't have a clear answer to that question. But I do want to point out that there's something about the idea of dual inheritance, this parallel cultural track, that bothers me. And it bothers me because it sounds a lot to me, and the word is also reminiscent, dualism, right? Dual inheritance, dualism. Of course, in philosophy of mind, we talk about dualism as a general term for there being some sort of immaterial substance that is one of the constituents of a human being. And of course, we know about Cartesian dualism. There's other variations on a theme of dualism. But I think for the most part, modern science has refuted this idea of some sort of supernatural, mysterious, immaterial substance. And I think for the most part, modern science has accepted that human beings are 100% biological creatures. And there's many variations of materialist theories of mind, which attempt to define with more specificity exactly what the relationship is between mind and brain. That's the function, one of the functions of a philosophy of mind, that the philosophy of mind is all about. What is the relationship between mind and brain? It doesn't suffice with any amount of precision or specificity to say, well, I believe that the mind is the brain, because what does the word is mean? It's a very, very ambiguous word. It's not a precise word at all. To say, well, my belief is simply something in my brain or a condition in my brain or a state of my brain, that doesn't really
You
get very clear, right, about what do you mean by is? Well, what do you mean is?
Yeah. At that point, you're doing a kind of psychological ontology. You know, anyone doing that would just be mapping the relation of what the mind is to what the brain is. And you're more talking about being than minds and brains and their relation.
Yeah, it's just it's non-specific and it's ambiguous, and it sort of suffers from what Bertrand Russell and others talked about when they said that language, like grammar, you know, the common language that people use is very ambiguous, and that's why, you know, like logical notation was developed. That was one of Russell's projects, right?
Yeah.
To find a way of expressing with more precision and less ambiguity what the world is like, facts about the world.
Mm-hmm.
So the word is doesn't really give us much precision. So that's why we have different theories of mind. That's why the philosophers of mind have developed various theories. These theories are the bridge between the mind and the brain. And there is, even in the world of materialist thought, so even let's take dualism and throw it out the window.
Yeah.
I know not everyone's ready to do that. Not everyone's ready to throw away spirit and soul and God and all that stuff, right? But just for the sake of argument, for the hypothetical experiment here, let's say we're only talking about materialist theories. Materialist theory being, in general, the claim that a human being, brain, mind, thoughts, beliefs are 100% biological. Theories of mind will then form a bridge between the mind and the brain to express with more precision exactly what that relationship is. In the world of materialist theories of mind, you have probably more than I can understand or can say right now, but in general, you have, for example, identity theories, which state that there's an identity relationship between consciousness and the brain. But then you have, as subcategories of identity theory, you have token identity, type identity. You know, is a state of mind type identical to a brain state, or is it token identical in that a particular instance of state of mind, a particular feeling or thought, or is that identical to a one-time occurrence, a one-time event of the biology of the brain? And then you have emergence theories that consciousness is biological, but somehow emerges from the biological brain, is not identical to. John Searle has a theory which is sort of like that, about biological naturalism, which is that, sure, he says, our consciousness is biological, but it emerges from the brain. It's not identical to the brain. So all these theories within the materialist world try and define what the relationship is between the mind and the brain, but they all are materialist theories. So We're going to have another edition of, we're going to have part four of this. So I'm just going to preview where I'm going to go in the next part. I'm going to make the claim that if we accept materialism, that our consciousness is in some way related to the brain such that our consciousness is 100% in the physical realm. Mm-hmm. Our consciousness, our intentionality, our beliefs, our emotions, they're situated in the world of the physical. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's safe to say. The way by which they're situated, their exact relationship to each other would be defined by a particular theory of mind that you were using. Mm. But if that's the case, then couldn't we extend that to culture? To the extent that culture is, say, a meeting of minds, right? Or the common beliefs or some relationship of many minds to each other. If that's what culture is, then by logical inference, wouldn't culture also be completely situated in the physical world?
Yeah, maybe.
So this is where I'm going to go. You know, I'm going to go here and say, well, culture is in a materialist world, you know, in a non-dualist, but in a materialist world, culture resides in the physical world. So wouldn't whichever theory of mind that you wanted to employ to define the relationship between an individual brain and mind, wouldn't that also apply to culture? Wouldn't you then need to use that same theory of mind to apply to multiple minds? Because multiple minds are just more minds.
Yeah.
If you're claiming that the mind has a certain relationship to a brain, then wouldn't it follow from that that two minds would have the same relationship to two brains?
Yeah.
Thank you, Brandon Brownlee. My name is Michael Robert Kaditz. You have been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca.
This is Birdnell. Take a close look at a male wild turkey, if you dare. This turkey is a hefty 4 feet of bird, tail tip to beak. Its handsome, dark, and densely feathered body is topped by a bare neck. And there, dangling from the chin, is a wrinkly mass of bumpy, warty-looking red skin. The wattle. Why have a wattle? Wattles are an adaptive feature that come in handy in several ways. On a hot day, with the sun bearing down, the bare skin of neck and wattle helps release excess heat. Birds don't sweat. They can't sweat. So the turkey is otherwise trapped in its dense, dark feathers. Wattles have other roles to play. When the male turkey gets to courting the hens, the wattle takes center stage. Extra blood rushes in, and the wattle glows bright scarlet for maximum visual impact. If a predator appears, sparking a moment of fear, the blood may retract from the wattle, turning it blue. Many birds have wattles, including some storks, plovers, pheasants, bellbirds, cassowaries, and, of course, the rooster in the barnyard. Are they pretty? In the right bird's eye, no doubt. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Did you know you can listen to Bird Note in your podcast app? Subscribe to Bird Note Daily and never miss an episode.
I'm Javin, and I play keyboards and sing in Young Pacific.
I'm Nathaniel. I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft.
Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m., right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.